This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
I see the melting horizon, a warning in the night. Our planet's pleading, can't you see the light?
So it's sort of like a ticking time bomb, some of the changes going on now. We know we've locked it in, or we're beginning to lock certain things in. And at some stage, they will play out. That can't be changed.
Ice is melting, oceans rising to the sky.
World-changing tipping points in Antarctica. Following an emergency summit of polar scientists in Australia, renowned expert Professor Matt King on tipping points in Antarctica and the Southern Ocean, how they could rearrange the world. Hidden from us all, huge changes are emerging at the bottom of the world, Antarctica. Hundreds of scientists just held an emergency summit in Australia. Just out, this new paper, Cascading Tipping Points of Antarctica and the Southern Ocean, published December 10th. Extinction-level global changes might start there, down under. Professor Matt King is a renowned Australian scientist specializing in polar geodesy and Arctic research. He is currently a professor at the University of Tasmania and director of the Australian Centre for Excellence in Antarctic Science. From Hobart, Tasmania, Matt King, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Great to be with you, Alex.
Well, for openers, what is geodesy and what has that got to do with Antarctic research?
It's a great question and a very common question. So geodesy is the study of the shape of the Earth, its gravity field and the way it rotates and how those things change over time. And all of those things change over time as mass is moved around the surface of the Earth. So as Antarctica or Greenland increasingly melt and that all that weight of water goes into the oceans, that changes the shape of the Earth, it changes Earth's gravity field, it changes the way Earth rotates and the axis of rotation and the rate of rotation. And so by studying those things, you can indirectly learn about the changes that are going on the surface of the Earth and also in the interior of the Earth as well. So we use measurements of the changing gravity of the Earth over Antarctica to understand how much ice is being lost into the ocean that's not being replaced by snowfall. That's one example of the use of geodesy in Antarctic science.
So you can do that from space without even having to measure from research stations on the spot?
Yeah, and there's a load of research that we do and can be done from space, from satellites orbiting a few hundred kilometres to much higher altitudes above the surface of the Earth. You know, some of those measurements are really great for Antarctica. Some of them are more limited because there's a lot of cloud over Antarctica quite often. And so anything that's sort of like an image-based, camera-based system is a bit more challenging. We use satellite-based measurements for everything from measuring the speed of the glaciers and how they're changing over time to the elevation of the ice, the gravity or the mass change, as I talked about, mapping surface melting on the surface of Antarctica that happens sometimes in the summer. You know, all those sorts of things can be done by space. I'd have to say, though, that getting into the field and making measurements in the field, whether that's from airborne platforms or on the ground, are absolutely critical. They can't be replaced by satellite measurements, but we can do a lot with satellites.
Here on Radio EcoShock, we cover tipping points a lot, including with Tim Lenton. An Australian scientist, Matthew England, suggested a deep Antarctic current might have tipped. But until this new paper, most of us think of Antarctica as a long-term story unwinding over centuries. Why look for tipping points there and in the Southern Ocean?
And that view of a slowly changing, almost frozen Antarctica that maybe changes over thousands of years, that was actually very common view, even in the 1980s, 1990s. And then as we've managed to collect information from the field, from satellite observations, we've seen very dramatic things happen over weeks, days, sometimes hours. And so we now know that Antarctica is not just sitting down in the bottom of the Earth frozen and not doing very much. We know that it's capable of changing very rapidly, and it has started to change rapidly in many areas. And we know that those things don't just stay in Antarctica. They come to us by way of changing sea levels, changing global weather and climate patterns. The work that you talked with Matt England about, that changes the amount of oxygen and nutrients being distributed into the deep ocean all around the world, and that'll have effects on our ability to feed human populations from fisheries. So we know that these things matter for everyone, and we know that things are changing and can change rapidly in Antarctica, so we know that now. And as we've built our knowledge base of Antarctica, we've seen that there are actually potentially tipping points. You know, if we push the glaciers on land, for instance, down in Antarctica, some of those are in a potentially unstable configuration. And by that I mean, if they retreat to a certain point and the bedrock is sort of ever deepening as you go in towards the interior of the ice sheet, so the ice is sitting on this bedrock that's ever deepening as you go into the interior, well, that's an unstable configuration. And if the ice retreats back to that point, it will start to run downhill, so to speak, and in a way that actually fully complies with the definition of a tipping point, and that it's self-reinforcing and it can be quite abrupt. We know that there are tipping points in the system, and we know that there are complicated tipping points in the system. You know, there are cascading tipping points. So the increase in melt that comes from the glaciers interrupts the ocean circulation that you've discussed previously. The melting of sea ice, that's the frozen ocean around Antarctica, well, that has tipping points that cascade into the biological systems. So the emperor penguin, one of the most iconic species on Earth, you know, they breed on the ice in the middle of winter. But if there is no sea ice, this frozen ocean, because the ocean's sufficiently warmed, the emperor penguins enter into their own tipping point, and that could occur by the end of the century. There's a bunch of very complicated tipping points, and they are not unrelated with each other. And so we need to understand what those look like, what rate of change could occur if we do pass them, when might we pass those tipping points, and what action do we need to avoid that, which is obviously the critical thing, because we just don't want to go there. But of course, you know, as with all tipping points, even once you pass a tipping point, every tenth of a degree still matters, because we can continue to push it downstream, so to speak, or we can act to avoid the worst, even with tipping points.
There's been a lot of concern in science and in the public about ocean circulation changing in the North Atlantic at the Gulf Stream or the AMOC, however you want to label it. And that certainly would affect weather in the United Kingdom and in North America and Europe. But here we have ocean currents around Antarctica and the Southern Ocean that we can barely even name. We don't really know what they are in the public. And yet, these are fundamental to the weather systems of the whole world. Would you talk a bit about those circulation systems and why they matter so much?
Antarctica is surrounded by is land with ice on top of it, surrounded by the ocean. It's quite different to the Arctic. In fact, it's the opposite of the Arctic, which is ocean surrounded by land. And there we have the mighty Southern Ocean completely circling Antarctica. And in the Southern Ocean, we have the Antarctic Circumpolar Current, which is the world's strongest ocean current that circles around, it literally does circle around Antarctica. It's a very powerful current that actually has been protecting Antarctica from mid-latitude and low-latitude climate warming, because it's very hard to penetrate through that circling of ocean water, and that's an area of ongoing study about how heat does get across that barrier. But we also know that actually some of the densest waters on Earth are formed around the coastline of Antarctica, and they sink down deep into the ocean and they go out and fill global ocean basins. You know, we're talking about 3,000 metres, 4,000 metres deep, you know, filling vast amounts of the ocean. So the things that happen in Antarctica are propagating out all over the world, and of course that water eventually comes back up to the surface, where whatever has been embedded in the water, you know, oxygen and nutrients, and has been transported along, well, those things come up to the surface, and so the changes that are happening now in Antarctica will eventually surface somewhere else in the surface waters of the Earth, and that's where they'll have the effect. So it's sort of like a ticking time bomb, some of the changes going on now. We know we've locked it in, or we're beginning to lock certain things in, and at some stage, they will play out. That can't be changed. So Antarctica does have an outsized role. We know that not even outside the ocean currents, you know, the the reflection of the white snow and ice, or relatively white ice, reflecting energy back into space. That keeps the Earth cool, drives seasonal change. You know, there's a whole bunch of other systems that actually govern global climate, and you know, the way Antarctica is at the moment has helped the planet stay the way it is, or has been until recently. So major change in Antarctica really results in major change for the planet in terms of our weather systems.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock, science-based news about the real world. To discuss more worrying news coming out of Antarctica, our guest is Dr. Matt King, polar expert and research leader. Matt, tell us about the first Australian Antarctic Research Conference held November 2024 in your backyard in Hobart.
Yeah, this was a really exciting meeting because for whatever reason, we've never had a national Antarctic Research Conference, at least not for 10 years. And we had 450 of Australia's leading Antarctic researchers come from all over the country into Hobart, and we met. And, you know, there are a number of things that struck me. First of all, there were a lot of early career researchers. This is an area of research that actually is full of hope because we've got, you know, an increasing number of young people generally who want to join in and help understand Antarctica, understand it, sort of revel in the awe and wonder of it, of the place that it is. It's such a special place, but also advance our knowledge as quickly as we can. And I'd say that we've not been advancing our knowledge as quickly as we need to get ahead of some of the surprises that have come at us. And we also spoke about some of those surprises. We talked about the dramatic changes in the sea ice around Antarctica, that is, you know, the frozen ocean that has dramatically declined in terms of its winter peak and its annual cycle over the last few years. That's not fully understood, but that was discussed. Changes in the ozone hole and the impact on Antarctic vegetation, that was discussed. Future sea level projections, that was discussed. Trying to understand very fine-grained details of how things work in Antarctica. Well, there were dozens of presentations about that, and loads of these had, you know, climate change sitting in the background, if not in the foreground of their presentations. And we also worked together on, you know, there's new marine science voyages that are underway next year, a major Australian Antarctic voyage to the Denman Glacier in Antarctica, which alone has 1.5 meters of sea level capacity. So that one glacier, if it all melted, would raise global sea levels on average by 1.5 meters, barely studied, and there's a voyage going down. And so some of the scientists who are working on that met together to talk and plan and discuss that piece of work. So there are things going on everywhere, but it was a very exciting meeting and really wonderful to have, you know, physical scientists, biological scientists, social scientists all there together talking about Antarctica and sharing knowledge.
Well, just to fill in the players, what is the Australian Antarctic Program Partnership? Who funds that and what does that do?
Yeah, so in Australia there's sort of four major bodies, I guess. So there's the Australian Antarctic Division, which is a government organisation. It runs Australia's bases, it runs the ships and the aircraft, it has science and policy people. And then there's the university sector, in which there are actually three large programs. One of them is the Australian Antarctic Program Partnership. It's based here at the University of Tasmania, and it's a partnership with some government agencies, including the Australian Antarctic Division. And it works to try and understand Antarctica's role in the global climate system, and is sort of, you know, focused very heavily on, you know, physical climate change, physical processes that are occurring in the climate system. And then there are a couple of other large efforts. The one that I lead is the Australian Centre for Excellence in Antarctic Science. It's a collaboration of seven universities across Australia where we're trying to understand climate risks that are coming from East Antarctica and the Southern Ocean. So we're working on that, and we partner very closely with the AAPP. And then there's another program based at Monash University called Securing Antarctica's Environmental Future. They've got a particular interest in ecosystems, especially on land, change policy, and how that all links with changing climate as well. And so all those groups are operating in parallel. We work together, and together we work together to coordinate this conference, this Australian Antarctic Research Conference.
Well, it's powerful science coming out of Australia. Now, you're not alone. China has established 5 research stations in Antarctica, with the latest being that futuristic Qinling station opening in February 2024. There's 70 permanent research stations in Antarctica, 29 countries. Australia's got 4 of them, but Argentina has 13. Japan's there, Pakistan, Bulgaria. Why are so many countries building bases there, and how good is the information sharing between these places?
So the first thing to say is that Antarctica is governed. No one owns Antarctica. Antarctica is governed by the Antarctic Treaty System, which was signed in 1959. And it's a remarkable document because it preserved, so the nations came together, who's the original signatories, and more have joined since, and they agreed that Antarctica be preserved for peace and science. And I think that's a wonderful thing to reflect on in a world that is, you know, where we see peace and science being preserved, you know, perhaps less than we would like, much less than we would like. Here we have Antarctica has been set aside for peace and science. And so that governs the use of Antarctica. You know, there are claims on Antarctica. Australia has those. They're effectively they're not thrown out, but they're not endorsed by the Antarctic Treaty. They're effectively frozen, so to speak, in time, and the Antarctic Treaty is in existence and will be out into the future. So nations are able to come to Antarctica for purposes of peace and science. The overwhelming activity in Antarctica from all those stations is scientific knowledge, and so nations want to gather knowledge that might inform on their own climate understanding, and so that's the heart of the reasons. You know, I think it would be foolish to say that there's not a geopolitical thing that's going on there in various places and they're complicated, but the overwhelming purpose of all of those stations, every one of them, regardless of which nation you look at, is all about science and doing science in their area of operations. And the collaboration between nations is excellent. Look, if you go even back to the Cold War, there were scientists exchanging, American scientists exchanging information with Russian scientists on Antarctica. And that tradition has long continued up to the present day, where nations work together because really they have to work together. Antarctica can't be solved by one nation or even a small group of nations. Logistically, you know, things break, things, you know, ships break down, they need to be rescued. That requires cooperation. We need to get people into the field. That requires cooperation on air transport. And so the whole thing only really works with cooperation, and science certainly is a collaborative effort.
Well, there's so much new science coming out. I'm hoping in the new year to spend at least one program investigating the tipping points and the other issues coming from the South Pole. I'm a little concerned about the time lag of getting these new ideas about what's going on there out to the public. It can be really slow to penetrate people's consciousness that, yes, we should be concerned about Antarctica and the Southern Oceans. Do you have ideas on how we can go beyond the science and get this word out?
Look, I completely agree. And even here in Australia, where, you know, the next stop south of us is Antarctica, Antarcticans can feel very far removed from our day-to-day existence. And yet, you know, every day our weather patterns are influenced by what's going on in the Southern Ocean. Every day a little bit of Antarctica arrives on our coastlines in the form of sea level rise. And there's a whole bunch of other things as well. But it is a real challenge, and it means, and actually it's a challenge for scientists to stop just doing science and actually collaborate and work really intimately with non-scientists, especially social scientists, but also people in economics and in other fields as well, because it's the stories of Antarctica that really will resonate and connect with people, you know. And so those people who are, you know, really passionate about Antarctica might fall into those who are, you know, care about the environment and the specialness of that place. That's been communicated through movie and film and novels. There are other people who have been connected in with Antarctica because they recognise actually it's an important part of our economy, actually, and they care about that. You know, there's $200 billion US a year of carbon absorbed into the Southern Ocean that would otherwise be in the atmosphere, and the economy would have to lift up to that extent to cover that carbon. So there's stories to be told, but we're not doing that really well at the moment. And I was even just reflecting, and maybe some of your listeners are interested in this. There's not even really a great sort of popular science book about Antarctica, as far as I know. For modern day science, you know, there's all the heroic era stuff of, you know, Scott of the Antarctic and Shackleton, Sir Douglas Mawson. Something that tells the current day science in a popular and accessible way, that's lacking. So we need to work harder on this, and it's not just the scientists who are going to solve that problem.
Calling all artists, have a look at Antarctica and see how you can help out. As we wrap up here, I just want to ask, I mean, I'm intrigued that the Earth can be deformed and that possibly even time itself can be just slightly altered by that. What kind of projects do geodesic specialists take up, and what are some of the high points learned?
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, we've known for more than a century that Earth changes shape. As the great ice sheets have melted, the Earth has rebounded in that area and they subside in other areas. And that's really about processes that are occurring deep within the Earth, in Earth's mantle, where you've got mantle material slowly moving around in response to that surface mass redistribution, the glacier melting into the ocean. One of the things that we're able to do with geodesy is attach really precise GPS instruments to the bedrock in Antarctica, and this is the work some of my team have done. And we can measure the motion of the bedrock, especially the vertical motion. You know, is the bedrock going up or is it going down? What rate is it going up? This is normally in sort of millimetres a year or sub-millimetres a year in some cases. And we can, to take one example, there was a dramatic breakup of a floating glacier in the Antarctic Peninsula called the Larsen B Ice Shelf. It broke up in days, thousands of icebergs scattered in the ocean. That didn't affect sea level directly because it was already floating, but it was retaining, like a retaining wall, it was holding back the glaciers that were flowing into it from upstream into the mountains. And they all of a sudden started to move faster by a factor of 4 to 6. That transfer of all that weight of ice into the ocean unloaded the Earth in a sort of a natural experiment. And so we were able to track how, you know, the bedrock was going up by maybe a millimetre a year before that, and all of a sudden it was going up at 6 millimetres a year. And we were able to use that to constrain our understanding of what the mantle is like 200 kilometres below the surface of the Earth and how quickly it responds. And we can use that and have used that information to inform on how the solid Earth might actually act as a brake on future glacier retreat. Because as the ice melts, the Earth rebounds, it lifts the glaciers a little bit out of the water, and it turns out that that's enough just to slow down the glaciers a bit. You know, maybe wholesale retreat will take several decades longer. And so, you know, good news stories out of Antarctic science in the last little while is that maybe the solid Earth will put a little bit of a brake on the retreat. That means we've got to keep on going with the climate mitigation. But, you know, there is a little bit of a good news story there. So geodesy has been at the heart of that discovery.
From Hobart, Tasmania, we've been speaking with Australian scientist Professor Matt King. He's the director of the Australian Centre for Excellence in Antarctic Science. You can find more on the new paper about Antarctic tipping points and the young scientist warning in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Matt King, thank you for spending time with us.
It's been a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Adding just a few tips from the early career Antarctic researchers, the East Antarctic ice sheet alone holds enough water to raise global sea levels by approximately 50 meters, that's over 150 feet, if completely melted. The services of the Southern Ocean and Antarctica as a great ocean sink and planetary air conditioner have been taken for granted. Recent research has shown record low sea ice, extreme heat waves exceeding 40 degrees C above average temperatures, and increased instability around key ice shelves. Runaway ice loss, rapid and catastrophic sea level rise is possible within our lifetimes. Whether such irreversible tipping points have already passed is unknown. Just like the rest of the world, extreme events are happening in Antarctica. They are just not in the news. New ecosystems will appear there as ice disappears from both the sea and on land. A new part of the planet is being revealed to life, or perhaps returned to life after many millions of years. Antarctica has been frozen for at least 14 million years, and maybe as long as 38 million years. About 100 million years ago, the continent was part of the supercontinent, Gondwana, in a different location on the planet. It was covered in forests, ferns, conifers, and flowering plants. But a modern life ecosystem will appear now on new ground and open seas as the Antarctic ice retreats. By the way, we talked about geopolitical in the interview. Russia claims the world's largest oil and gas reserves are in the UK's zone of interest in the Antarctic. At 511 billion barrels, it is far more than Venezuela's 300 billion in reserves. If this oil and gas is drilled and burned, the climate for mammals is over. One expert concludes Russia will not attempt to break the Antarctic norms and treaties in its current weakened state, and due to the very high cost of technology to survive Antarctic conditions. We shall see. It is a wild west down there. Some countries claim territories, others ignore the claims and build bases wherever they want. The last safe space for peace and science is always at risk. Stay tuned to Radio EcoShock for more news on Antarctic tipping points that could change the world.
Radio EcoShock.